This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Ahead this hour, we'll be looking at the barriers to education for girls around the world and what a difference it can make in their lives if they get one. Local author Tanya Lee Stone has a new book out on the topic. We'll also talk with NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman later in the show. But first, we go to the Vermont State House, where an unusual event unfolded this morning. Lawmakers were supposed to start recounting the ballots that citizens cast 3 months ago in one certain legislative race in order to determine the results of that election. There was a lot of controversy surrounding this recount, and it was supposed to be done with very strict procedures in place. But the two-day recount ended abruptly before it had even begun this morning. VPR's Peter Hirschfeld joins us from our Montpelier studio to fill us in on the details. Hi, Pete.
How you doing, Jane?
I'm well. This is a kind of a remarkable set of events that happened this morning.
We have our work cut out for us here explaining exactly what went down this morning.
I know. We can take it step by step. And I guess the first thing to do is just maybe you can back up and explain. The seat that's under scrutiny is one of two House seats that cover five towns in Orange County. Can you remind us of the four candidates who were competing for those two seats in November?
Yeah, we had Republican Rodney Graham. He won outright. He had over 2,000 votes. There was another Republican, Bob Frenier, who got 1,853 votes. Then there was the incumbent progressive, Susan Hatch Davis, who got 1,845 votes after the first count. That's only eight fewer, you'll notice, than Republican Bob Frenier. A fourth candidate, also a progressive, named Adam DeLaurier, got just over 1,000 votes.
So the question was then who gets the second seat between Bob Frenier, the Republican, and the progressive incumbent Susan Hatch Davis, because just eight votes between them. And so a recount was conducted because that was so close between Davis and Frenier. And that recount narrowed Frenier's victory from eight votes to seven votes, but it was still a victory. So why were lawmakers even attempting to do a second recount today?
Well, Susan Hatch Davis tried to get a Washington County judge to force a second recount. That judge said, look, I see no reason here to suspect that another recount would deliver a different result. Susan Hatch Davis was undeterred. She took her case to the Vermont House of Representatives, which, under a provision in the Vermont Constitution, can order a recount in any race involving members of its own body. And lawmakers said, look, there are a couple reasons that we think it makes sense to move forward with another recount. The major one of those reasons was to have a visual inspection of the ballots before they go through these automated tabulators. They say it's been demonstrated very clearly in previous recounts, including one that happened this year, that when you have errant markings on a particular ballot, it can throw off the tabulator's accuracy. And in that other recount, they looked at the ballots before inserting them one by one into the tabulator, and ballots that any reasonable person would say showed an intent to vote for one candidate didn't register as such by the tabulator. That can apparently happen when you have these errant markings. So they said, in the interest of ensuring accuracy here, let's use that process in a second recount.
So that's what the legislature was saying, but there was also a lot of criticism from people outside of the legislature and perhaps within in some cases that this was actually politically motivated, not motivated by a desire to actually get the most accurate results. Was there any evidence that this was a purely politically motivated attempt?
No, there was no hard evidence. Now, House Minority Leader Don Turner made some really intense allegations over this. And in fact, in January, after the House made it clear that it was going to move forward with the second recount, said he was of the belief that they were going to willfully manipulate this recount process in order to orchestrate Bob Frenier's ouster. He didn't have any hard evidence to back that up. He admitted as much. He said it's just what he thinks is going on here. But certainly this whole thing has been steeped in political division from the outset.
Well, and that explains somewhat the very strict procedures that lawmakers had put themselves under to conduct this recount. Everyone arrived at the State House this morning. They're expecting this very deliberate, very careful process that they said would unfold over 2 days, and they'd be recounting all of these 6,700 ballots from the five towns. And, you know, Pete, I thought I was going to be talking to you about what are the first few hours, what have they been like? And instead, we're talking about something that didn't even happen. What did happen?
So I showed up at Room 11, which is this largish state house meeting room where the recount was supposed to happen. You talk about the security efforts and protocols that they had in place. They literally changed the locks on Room 11 prior to this recount happening to address some of those security concerns. There were a couple dozen lawmakers milling about outside the room, which had not been opened yet. And pretty quickly, I got a sense that something was up, mainly because a Republican lawmaker, his name is Jansen Wilhoit, sort of is mouthing to me, "It's over. It's over." I'm like, "What do you mean it's over?" And he explained this revelation that one of the bags, bag from Chelsea that contained ballots, had been unsealed, and that this unsealing was plainly in violation of the policies and procedures that had been set up for this particular legislative recount. Sure enough, the situation bared out just like Jansen Wilhoit said it would. Everybody was ushered into Room 11. The lawmakers were seated at the tables where the recount was going to have happened, and Dawn Turner and Maida Townsend, who's the Democratic chairwoman of the House Committee on Government Operations, explained to everybody that as a result of that unsealing, which had happened on December 29th after the last recount, the second recount had been called off and Frenier will be declared the winner.
Let me just repeat back to you what you've just said to me so I can make sure I totally understand it. There was a problem back in December. The Chelsea town clerk realized that this voter checklist had been sealed inside the ballot bag and shouldn't have been. So the Chelsea town clerk is trying to figure out, what do I do now? The Secretary of State's office says, go ahead, open the bag, and then reseal the bag with just the ballots inside. But perhaps those weren't actually the proper instructions to be given in the first place. Anyhow, this all happens in December, and then a few weeks later, lawmakers create the guidelines around how they're going to do this extra recount. They don't know about the issue with the ballot bag, that it's been unsealed and resealed, and they create these rules that actually mean that if the bag had been resealed, they can't actually do the recount. They just didn't know that this had happened in the first place, so they had already created rules that were violated, and now they can't do the recount. Do I have that right?
You have that exactly right. The Secretary of State's office has been testifying regularly before the House Committee on Government Operations, and this issue of the unsealing of that bag never came up over the course of their deliberations. Now, the Secretary of State's office says, it never occurred to us to bring this up. This happens all the time. This town clerk had inadvertently left the checklist in the bag. As you said, she emailed the town clerk, the Secretary of State's office, sought permission to get that checklist out of the bag, and then resealed it. There's some question about whether or not that was done under the strict word that's called for in statute. But in any event, the Secretary of State stuff says this happens all the time. We didn't think it was even something they needed to know about it. Lawmakers now are a little perplexed and angry, frankly, that the issue of the sealing and unsealing was not brought to their attention by the Secretary of State's office until yesterday. Jim Kondo said, look, we really thought this was wholly irrelevant to the matters at hand.
You've actually talked to some of the lawmakers who are upset about this. What are they telling you?
I got a chance to talk with Bob Frenier himself, the Republican who will now officially and incontrovertibly be the winner in this race. He was not a fan of this process from the outset, and he said as much when I spoke with him this morning.
It was a comedy of errors from start to finish. The allegations that the judge threw out in court, they were all bull feathers.
Bull feathers.
You know, you gotta love when you hear a new term. That one was new to me. He actually kind of wishes that there had been a recount after having endured all of this, because he says, look, there is no doubt in my mind that we would have had a confirmation of the results that had been certified three times prior. But he says, look, it really does shine a light on some of the insanity of the process that we can invoke when it comes to these recounts, and we probably ought to do something about it.
Well, what about the lawmakers who had actually initiated the recount? What are they saying today?
They're obviously this isn't a good look for anybody, right? You go through a 2-month process designed to yield as reliable a process with as much integrity as they could come up with. And then the moment before it's about to begin, you find out that circumstances have prevented it from happening at all. And they're really unhappy with the Secretary of State's office. They feel like information was withheld from them that should have been brought to them. And Maida Townsend, that Democratic chairwoman of the House Committee on Government Operations, made her distaste pretty unclear at a press conference today.
That we don't know this until the day before we're supposed to start a recount, it raises all kinds of questions, not the least of which I mentioned before is what else might be out there that we don't know about.
That sounds a little ominous.
Yeah, and there is, perhaps unnecessarily so, there's nobody saying that there was any malicious intent here by anybody. Nobody thinks that when the town clerk unsealed this ballot bag, it was done with the intent of somehow tampering with the contents therein. But it has put a spotlight on some of the ambiguities that exist in elections law, some of the procedural arcane aspects of the procedures that we use for recounts and counts here in Vermont. And lawmakers say, look, this didn't go down any way like we thought it would. It's a bit of an embarrassment for everybody. But they say the silver lining here is that we have had a bunch of time to do a deep dive into Vermont elections law. We found some things that we think we need to change, and they say they are hoping to pass legislation before the end of this year that address some of those issues.
Huh. You know, you talk about blame being laid kind of willy-nilly at the moment, but I can imagine a lot of it is sort of hurled at the feet of Jim Condos, the Secretary of State, and you mentioned that he says, look, I just didn't think this was a big deal. I didn't think this was an issue. Is that still his line this morning now that this has all gone down?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think he feels bad for his elections director, frankly. This is the guy that had been testifying before the House committees. He was the one that it just didn't occur to him that he should bring it up. Jim Condo said, look, there were four or five instances in this election alone where we okayed the unsealing and resealing of a bag due to something that had been left in there that needed to be pulled out. So he says, look, it's unfortunate that this happened, but to lay blame at the feet of our office misses the mark in this case. And he says, in his mind, this revelation is in no way cause to stop the recount, but he notes that they didn't even support the recount in the first place. town clerks were very much against doing this. They said this is lawmakers getting into a business they have no business getting their hands on. And so I'm sure that with the passage of time, tempers that flared today will diffuse, but certainly elections issues are not going to be going away this session, and expect to see some legislation pop up as a result of this whole episode.
That's VPR political reporter Peter Hirschfeld. Pete, thanks very much for updating us on this story.
Yeah, good to be with you.
And listeners, you can continue to look for updates to this story at vpr.net. Just ahead, how education changes the lives of girls in developing nations. We'll hear stories that illustrate the struggle from local author Tanya Lee Stone. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. In many parts of the developing world, basic education is an aspirational goal. It's not a given. And it's even more of a challenge for young girls to get schooling. Priya, a young girl in India who has fought hard to make sure she gets to school, says, when you get an education, you become part of society. Without an education, you are left out. Her story is one of many that Vermont author Tanya Lee Stone tells in her new book, Girl Rising. Tanya joins us today to tell us some of the stories of the girls in this book and to look at the barriers to education for young women around the world. Tanya Lee Stone, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me back.
Can you tell us a little bit about this book, Girl Rising, and the project that surrounds it? It's a big project.
It is a big project. In fact, it started out as a film, a documentary, and that's how I was exposed to it first. In 2013, I went to see the film at the Roxy with a group of teenagers. And I was pretty much blown away by the beauty of it and the powerful, terrible impact that it had, kind of all at once. As we witnessed nine stories of nine girls from around the world, each who had overcome a fairly severe obstacle to education in order to be there in the film telling their stories.
And you said, I can do more?
Well, what I said was, wow, they must have done so much work in order to be able to whittle it down to these nine stories. I can't imagine that this organization, Girl Rising, doesn't have a wealth of additional information about a lot of other girls. And basically what happened was I tried to have a conversation with the teens that I had gone to see the film with a couple of weeks after we had seen it to sort of see what their takeaway was. The film itself is such a powerful piece, and the emotional takeaway is absolutely there. But when I wanted the teens to sort of talk about, well, what were those obstacles to education, and where do they exist, and why do they exist, that was more difficult for them to speak to. And so I thought it would be a really wonderful thing if I were able to be in some kind of a collaboration with them and really create something where I could unpack these obstacles, really kind of break them apart, and have something like a book that you could hold in your hands and reread and really think about and discuss as a tool.
Listeners, if you too have some questions about the barriers to education, the obstacles that girls have to overcome in many places around the world just to get an education, give us a call. If you have questions for Tanya Lee Stone, now's the time to call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Tanya, can you tell us one of the stories that might help illustrate some of those barriers that you're talking about, some of the obstacles?
Sure. I think first it's sort of important to ground us in what are kind of the broad strokes of what those are. What does that look like? Obviously, poverty and gender discrimination are sort of the large umbrella. But underneath that are things like child marriage, early child marriage and childbirth, modern-day slavery, which is human trafficking, and a very big obstacle, which is just limited access to education for a variety of reasons, sometimes distance, always money. So these obstacles play out in many different ways in many different cultures. One that comes to mind quickly is Soka. Soka, from Cambodia, was literally living in a dump, picking litter and garbage in bare feet and rags 5 or 6 years ago. And because of the work of some non-governmental organizations, NGOs on the ground, who are working with girls in a variety of places to get them out of the situations that they're in and into schools, her entire life changed. And today, she's a college student in Chicago. And that is really, I think, the starkest example of cause and effect that I can give you quickly.
You know, all of the young women profiled in this film, Girl Rising, by the organization, and we should say this organization is devoted to getting girls access to education and allowing them to have educations.
That's right.
These are remarkable stories. But there are usually stories of people who did get an education. And so you sort of wonder about maybe their peers who aren't getting one and what that's like. And you write in the book that educating girls literally changes how nations behave. Educating girls changes how governments function. It changes economies and jobs. It changes the shape of healthcare. It changes how families are raised. It can change entire cultures.
That's right.
How?
One basic reason about that is that when girls earn more money, they tend to spend it within their families. And that is different statistically than how boys spend money. So just by that nature, it changes what happens within the small culture of a family. That means that the children in that family also get educated in the next generation. She's less likely to marry and have children later if she's educated. There will be fewer infant deaths. The infant mortality rate goes down. She'll be healthier and live longer. This changes health care in whole communities. She'll be able to get a better job. All of those things exponentially changes the makeup of a culture.
And yet it's still not happening. You also write in the book the statistic that is not entirely accurate because it's difficult to know how many people are not
right.
getting schooling, but some 62 million girls around the world are
That's
not
right.
getting education. So if you know this and NGOs know this about the positive outcomes of education and governments know this and more people know this, why is it still not happening?
Money. It costs a lot of money to send people to school. And even though some governments might know it from data being available, it doesn't mean that it's their priority necessarily. You know, in places where it's hard enough to have enough food, to have enough money for shelter, to have enough money for clothing, and school is not free in those countries, it just becomes an obstacle that's too hard to overcome without assistance. And assistance costs money.
So then, you know, for you in writing this book and looking at this issue, you know, clearly the aim is eventually to make sure that girls have access to education. But what you just described almost seems like, all right, there's the stopping point. It's not happening. People know it and there's not enough money to go around.
Right. It's easy to get stopped in your tracks and feel overwhelmed by this problem. And that's exactly why I wrote the book. I wanted to kind of find a way for myself to learn more about this and explore these issues because I felt completely overwhelmed by it. And I think that awareness, education, bringing ideas to as many people's attention as possible is a way to slowly overcome that feeling of being overwhelmed. It's also the reason why the book is filled with hopeful stories of girls. So we have kind of a combination of light and dark in this book. The whole part one, which is sort of giving readers a grounded context of what are these obstacles, where do they happen, why do they happen, is dark. It's distressing. And so then I think in order to keep turning the page, we really need these stories to exemplify and illustrate how some of these amazing kids were able to change their lives completely and take hope from them being, even though they're the tip of the iceberg could be rising.
It's so tough, though. In some of the stories, these are children who fought for their own educations, and that's putting a lot on the shoulders of 6, 7, 8, 9-year-olds.
Yes.
I mean, you think about any children you know, and to expect them not only to see the value of education, but to fight for it against all of these odds and against all of these adults who are creating these barriers in addition to the societal barriers.
Right.
Boy, that is a tough thing to put on a little kid's shoulders.
It is. And at the same time, story after story of these girls, it was so obvious that these are incredibly resilient people. And because they don't necessarily come into the world with any privilege, their understanding of how valuable that is it's extraordinary. So when they get that, they latch on.
I'm talking with Tanya Lee Stone, a Burlington writer whose new book is Girl Rising, Changing the World One Girl at a Time. And we're talking about the barriers to education for girls around the world. If you have a question or an experience you'd like to share, our number is 800-639-2211. That's 800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Tanya, could you tell us another story that illustrates one of the barriers or some of the issues that are arising in getting girls access to education?
Sure. One of the things that the film did really nicely was that each story was sort of representative of an obstacle to education. And so as Mara from Ethiopia kind of quickly comes to mind for me when I think about child marriage, that's a remarkable story. And for several different reasons. Basically, the story is that Atenesh, the mom of Asmera and Meselu, her brother, had lost her husband. And so the brother, Meselu, had to leave school and work in the fields. And as time went by, things were getting a little bit more dire. And, a stranger came to ask for Asmera as his bride. Now, the thing that I think is always really important for we in the West to remember is that we don't understand the depth of cultural differences often. And so we're very quick to put our own perspectives on a different culture and have an opinion or a judgment about it. So one might hear this story that Asmara's mother is about to hand her over at 14 to a stranger in marriage and think, wow,
what a terrible mother.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But in fact, this is the thing that Atenesh has been raised by generations to do to protect her daughter. This is actually, from Atenesh's perspective, a loving thing to do. This will save her daughter from not having enough food to eat, for example, and give her a better life. But what's starting to change in the world, and partly because of our ability to communicate globally, is that this new generation of kids, Meselu and Asmara, they know better. They have different ideas that challenge even their own cultural norms. So Meselu, Asmara's brother, came running from the fields to stop his mother from doing this and said, I will give anything I need to give for you not to do this. Let Asmara stay in school. That will be the better way for her to have a life. And because her brother stood up for her, Asmara had the courage to do the same. And the family worked through it and kept Asmara in school. And I love that story, not only because it's a good example of how things can be different to change this issue of child marriage, but also to remember the father figures in the world that are important. Because boys matter just as much as girls. And in a lot of instances, it is father figures, it's brothers, it's uncles, it's fathers and grandfathers who are standing up and saying no to some of these things. And my experience just in talking about this book lately has been that boys are just as interested in learning about this as girls. In fact, I was at a school in Duxbury, Massachusetts, and an after-school group came to see me that was all about girls' global education. And the majority of the members of that group were teenage boys. So it's kind of a good thing to remember, both from a cultural perspective, that we don't always know best. We don't always know what's going on. And that this is a community effort. It's not one person's job to fix this.
What did those American boys tell you about why they were interested in this issue?
They basically told me that because they had had no idea that this was happening, when they first heard about it through seeing the film Girl Rising, they were shocked and outraged. And their first inclination was, how can we help spread awareness of this, because this shouldn't be happening?
You mentioned, Tanya, this idea of not imposing Western cultural norms or judgments on people, and I take your point. But aren't you also still saying that in order to change the story for young girls around the world who aren't getting this education or who are being married off at a very young age, even if that is the sort of the most loving or the most the option that may give a girl the best chance of having a life and having money and having enough food in the eyes of her parents, aren't we still saying, well, those cultural norms in that culture still need to change in order for girls to have an education? I mean, we may not be imposing a Western cultural judgment, but it's still saying your culture needs to change, isn't it?
Yes, in many ways it is. And I think that that's sort of par for the course. And I think that has to do with our new-ish ability to communicate globally. I think it's a changing paradigm. And so I think it has more to do with the older generations kind of learning from the newer generations.
Around the world, not imposed by Western norms that are changing those through media that gets to other places?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's also a balance. I mean, you can't swoop in and tell somebody what to do. You know, there are lots of examples of people in other cultures making their own choices, and those are their own choices. But in situations like the ones that are in the book, where it's appropriate, where there are NGOs that are working in cooperation with people who want to be working towards these goals, I think that's a different story.
So when you created this book, and, you know, this is a book that really any adult can read and find it pretty
Absolutely.
Fascinating, but you've also geared it to younger readers as well, as many of your books are geared towards. Do you imagine young American girls, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-olds reading these stories and seeing these faces shining back at them that may look a lot like they do, but have these very, very different stories?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my goals for this was to really impress upon readers that these are not other girls in other places. These are girls. These are just girls. Some are extraordinary. Some are less than extraordinary, just like all of us. And to really recognize that we're all global citizens. And also to sort of realize that getting involved in these kinds of causes when you do have privilege and when you do have some extra maybe time on your hands, like a Western teenager might have here, it doesn't take a lot to help expand awareness. It doesn't have to be an overwhelming thing. It doesn't have to be a huge activism project that, you know, is daunting. And so the whole last part of the book really is geared towards helping readers figure out how they can get involved and help in small ways, in big ways, sort of aligning what their passions are with things that they can do. There are so many creative things that somebody can do and just take their passion and make something up that is to increase awareness.
Like what? Give us a few examples.
Well, you know, if a kid is involved in creating films or art, or they like to write, you know, they could write an op-ed piece for their local newspaper. They could do an art project and get a gallery show together with some other artists. If they are cyclists, they could, you know, put together a project that would raise money to buy a bike for a girl in a school, a girl in an area that can't get to school without a bike. Just so many things.
We got a note from Anne who says, in the opinion of your guest, what is the best institution or fund that I can support to improve girls' education worldwide?
There are actually many excellent organizations, and I include a list of them in the back of Girl Rising. Girl Rising, of course, itself is an organization. Girl Rising started as a film, but became a movement, which I find extraordinary. You know, these are a group of documentary filmmakers who made this film and then basically decided to devote the rest of their time to working on these issues and partnering with the NGOs that they had met during the process. So there's Girl Rising. There's Girl Up, which is part of the United Nations. There are really several. And if you don't have the book, I think I would like to go home today, in fact, and remember to put a list up on my website for people to see.
Good. We will link to your website from
Great.
Today's show page at vpr.net.
Great. I think that's an important piece
Good.
To
we'll,
get out there.
We'll look for that list. Is there another story of another girl in this book or in the movie that's profiled that you would like to talk about?
Sure. Gosh, there are so many of these stories that are touching.
There's a remarkable story of a young woman who wears a burqa, who lives in Afghanistan, and she speaks very defiantly about the life that she wants for herself, for example. I mean, so many stories that you profile. And
That's true. That's true. She's an incredible girl. She's one of our identity-protected girls. So I will not pontificate on hers for fear of saying something that I don't have in the book. Suma, actually, who is on the cover of the book, sort of looking skyward. Suma is an example of someone who was subjected to modern slavery, forced labor in Nepal. And she's an incredible girl. And I think one of the things that I was so struck by in Suma's story was her nature, her beautiful soul, just a person who was so hurt and suffered so much. But when Martha Adams, the producer, was with her and said to her, you know, do you like to sing? She just started singing in this incredibly haunting, gorgeous voice, a song that she had written herself. And for me, throughout the film, there were stories of girls who had found some kind of art form that spoke to them, that they used to cope with their suffering. And I found that to be a really beautiful and resilient thing about all of them. And that really stayed with me about Suma, after learning everything that she had been through in multiple masters' houses. You know, here was a girl who was able to move forward and process these things and write a song about it and end up at a Women in the World Summit in New York City on the stage of Lincoln Center singing that song for people.
Pretty remarkable.
Amazing.
Tanya Lee Stone is a Burlington writer whose new book is Girl Rising, Changing the World One Girl at a Time. She will be doing a book talk at Phoenix Books in Burlington the first week in March, and we have details on our show page at vpr.net. Tanya, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane.
Coming up, NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman talks about covering national security and also why he has been advocating for military veterans to go to St. Michael's College, his alma mater. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You hear Tom Bowman's voice all the time here on VPR. He is NPR's Pentagon correspondent. He covers the military and the Defense Department and has reported from Afghanistan and Iraq for the network. Bowman is also an alum of St. Michael's College in Colchester, and he's been working with the college to encourage more veterans to attend. Bowman will be back at the college tomorrow evening talking about his war reporting, and he joins us now. Tom, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
Could you talk a little bit about what you're observing at the Pentagon and the Department of Defense since the election of Donald Trump?
Well, there's still a great amount of chaos in Washington, sort of in all the agencies, including the Pentagon. There still are a lot of vacancies at the Pentagon and the State Department while they try to work things out. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis would like his people. The Trump people want their people. So there's a bit of a tug of war going on now as far as who's going to take some of these top jobs. And, you know, they're going to come up pretty soon, maybe even next week, with a new strategy against the Islamic State, for example. And also they're going to address Afghanistan and whether a few thousand more troops should be sent over to help train the Afghan forces. Some could come from the U.S., some from NATO countries. So those are the issues now. But, yeah, again, it's a different time. It's unique in our history that we have a president that doesn't have any experience governing or really no experience in domestic national security, foreign policy. And then you have a White House that is somewhat dysfunctional as well. So it's an interesting time to be a reporter, and they're still trying to work through some of these issues, particularly with personnel appointments.
Well, how do you then think about your approach to your stories when, you know, not only is the administration different, it's openly hostile to the media, and you're reporting within a field that's already so closely aligned with secrecy and security. How do you get access to the sources that you need, make sure that you can get the deep knowledge that you need, but also still maintain your objectivity?
Well, first, as far as objectivity, I mean, reporters, probably more so than anyone else, are closely, you know, following the news, closely following the issues. We probably have our own opinions on a lot of issues. The point of being a reporter is to gather facts, find out what's going on and why, and sort of leave your views, your political views, your whatever views you have on the issues off to the side and just stick with what's going on and why and who's doing what, why are they doing it, how many troops will they send or might they send to Afghanistan, and keep it at that.
But I imagine you still have to cultivate sources in a way that might be different, say, from how I do it.
You know, it's I don't think it's that different. One of the benefits of covering the Pentagon, particularly in what we're seeing now with this great upheaval in Washington, is that, you know, the military kind of stays put. So there are a lot of officers I deal with at the Pentagon that I've known for years. I just left the office of one particular senior military officer talking about, again, ISIS and Afghanistan. So, and that's one of the benefits of going to places like Iraq and Afghanistan. You're out in the field with them, and you get to know them. And then when you come back to Washington, they want to talk with you. They want to understand what you saw when you were over, let's say, going out with Afghan troops or American troops, because sometimes they don't have the access that I have. Hmm. When they show up, it's a huge deal. When I show up, you can just kind of go off and patrol with these people. If you're a 1, 2, 3 star officer, it's almost like a papal visit in a way. So it's kind of nice to kind of slip in there, get a sense of what's really going on. Again, not only talking to American troops and officers, but also to the Afghans, regular Afghans or Afghan soldiers. It's a rich experience as a reporter to go over there and really get a sense of what's going on. And the added benefit, again, is you're dealing with officers who will then rise up the ranks. I've been going to Afghanistan since 2002, and some of the people who I knew back then who were colonels are now 4-star generals.
You know, you go even further back, in fact, with a very powerful person in the U.S. military. You went to St. Michael's College, and you were classmates with General Joseph Dunford, who is now chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was appointed by President Obama. He's still there. It sounds like he's worked pretty closely in the past with the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis. But I understand you don't actually have any college dirt on your classmate.
I do not. We traveled in different circles. He was in ROTC when he was at St. Michael's and lived in a different dorm. And I didn't really get to know Joe Dunford until he became a 1-star general. This is maybe, within the past decade or so, I would say. So not at St. Michael's, but, you know, many years later.
You're coming back to St. Michael's College to talk about your reporting from Iraq and Afghanistan. My understanding of the way the talk is going to work is that you're also going to be joined by a veteran who lives in Vermont, and we'll be talking about what it's like to be in the military in these conflicts. That's a really interesting pairing. How did that come about?
Well, they invited me up to St. Mike's, and they said, do you want to talk, and how do you want to go about doing this? I said, well, rather than having me up there droning on, it'd be nice to have one of the veterans come up and we can kind of do a dog and pony show, so to speak, about, what are his views on what's going on in Afghanistan? What did he experience? I can talk about my own experiences. I think I'm going to play one of my stories from a few years back ago in Afghanistan and then just take questions and answers, from questions from the crowd and kind of go from there. I think it's important to have a veteran, too, on the stage when you're talking about something like this, particularly at St. Michael's, where they've tried to draw in more veterans over the past few years. And I think it's good for everyone. It's good for the veterans to kind of welcome them back into society, help them get an education in a place like St. Michael's. And it's also good, I think, for the students who have different backgrounds, who may have just come from, let's say, high school in Connecticut and really probably don't know many people in the military. So it's good to have in that classroom environment, I think, where some of the professors maybe don't have who teach, let's say, political science or recent history. It's a view that everyone should hear. The professors should hear and the students should hear as well. I think it provides a richer dialogue in a class, I think.
You said that St. Michael's has been actively trying to recruit more veterans to come to campus and go to St. Mike's, and that's actually something that you've been involved in?
Right. I was involved in it, and my classmates, Mike Slifka and Brian Harrington, really did a lot of the heavy lifting on this. This is a number of years ago. And then we asked the administrators back then, how many veterans do you have? And they said, really not too many. And this was at a time when, veterans were starting to go back to school. Maybe some of them had associate's degrees and they wanted to get a 4-year degree. There was a concern, of course, that they were going to some of these diploma mill places. So they would spend all their Defense Department money, $40,000 or so, on what was really not a great degree, let's face it. So we started talking about it among ourselves and said, well, maybe St. Michael's would be a good place to bring some of these people in. So they hired a veterans coordinator, and they've been encouraging veterans to continue their education at St. Mike's. And I look forward to meeting with some of them and then being on stage with one of them.
And you think it's been a successful program, a successful initiative?
As far as I can tell, it has. But again, I haven't been up to the school in a number of years, so I'm going to have to talk to the administrators and talk to the veterans and just see how it's working. But from what I hear, it is working quite well, and everyone's happy with it. And again, everyone benefits. The veterans benefit from getting a good education, and the students are, introduced to someone who is probably vastly different in background from their peers. And the professors also get a view outside of the textbooks and outside of what they're reading, someone who experienced the Afghan war and can provide, you know, maybe fresh ideas or a fresh perspective that they're just not going to get anywhere else.
That's Tom Bowman. He's NPR's National Desk Reporter covering the Pentagon. He's also a St. Michael's College graduate, and he will be speaking at St. Mike's tomorrow night at 6 in the McCarthy Arts Center. The talk is open to the public, and again, he'll be joined by a veteran as they talk about the wars and conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tom, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for talking
with us. Okay, thanks. Really enjoyed it.
All right, that does it for today's show. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.